everyone. Welcome to Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster for the website. Hope you guys are having a great early week, early part of your week. Want to get this up a little bit earlier than usual because so much happened this past weekend. It was just absolutely wild, crazy, all types of overused terms, but it was really, really interesting stuff to happen from inside the cage, outside the cage, all types of stuff that's going to be talked about for quite some time. And helping me break down that 36 hours, I almost said crazy again, helping me break down that 36 hours is Sam Kaplan, a former guest on the show. Sam was the Bellator lead matchmaker back in the Bjorn Rebney era. Also, Five Ounce of Pain. He founded 5 Ounce of Pain, a publication that was really kind of ahead of its time. This is before MMA fighting and really kind of get going. And was right up there with Sure Dog and Junkie and so on. So that was really influential in the sport. And I've done podcasting before, all that stuff. So he's pretty well involved in the sport and really was interested in talking about this as well. So what follows is about a 40-minute or so conversation between Sam and I, breaking down 36 hours in the world of mixed martial arts. Enjoy. Well, a wild weekend just happened in the world of mixed martial arts. Seems like every weekend is wild. Every week is wild. And I'm going to go over a stretch of about 36 hours or so that was memorable, to say the least. And helping me do that this week is a past guest, someone we welcome back with open arms. He's the former matchmaker of Bellator MMA, 5 Ounces of Pain founder, fight consulting, all kinds of other stuff. Sam Kaplan is back. And Sam, it has been a long time since we last talked to you. So I guess the first really hard-hitting question will be, what have you been up to? How are things going?
Not doing too much in the MMA world these days. My focus primarily has been on sales and sales consulting and training. Also have a 19-month-old daughter. So I've been pretty busy outside of MMA. I still keep up with it and follow it as a fan, and I still have some industry contacts that I speak with. But, Josh, it's great to be back with you. And you said it pretty aptly. The last 36 hours have been insane.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild. I mean, however, I must ask you, though. So a 19-month-old, is this your first child?
Second child. I have an 18-year-old son from a previous marriage.
Gotcha. So I have a father of a 13-month-old first child. So I can relate to some of the craziness. Sometimes the stuff in MMA seems secondary to all the stuff that kind of goes on with kids. But nonetheless, hats off to you and all the other fathers and parents out there listening. It is a wild job, no doubt. Right. So we will get to. All right. So let's start. I kind of broke this down into a timeline format because this is really the way to kind of make sense of all this. So let's start on Friday morning. So East Coast time. So Friday morning, MMA Junkie writes a story, prints a story, runs a story on the Bellator Heavyweight Grand Prix Tournament. We finally have an answer for this heavyweight title. The title has not been defended in several years. It's just been this big question mark. And the fact it went this long is kind of weird. But however, we're at this point where we are going to have throughout 2018, knock on wood that no injuries take place, that's going to delay this to 2019, but an 8-man tournament involving some of the, obviously, Bellator heavyweights, well-known guys, but also some light heavyweights. So get this field. Fedor Emelianenko, Roy Nelson, we have Matt Mitrione, Frank Mir, recently signed from the UFC after he was released, and then we have the newly re-signed Rampage Jackson. King Mo is going to fight at heavyweight again. And then we have a couple interesting names in current light heavyweight champion Ryan Bader. And then the one and only Chael Sonnen, who's going to be involved in this 8-man tournament happening throughout the year. When you first read about this field and even kind of hearing of that and thinking about potential matchups, it sounds like we're going to get Fedor versus Mir first. What's going through your head?
Well, Scott Coker is a huge fan of Pride, and this tournament is straight out of the playbook of Pride. I mean, it feels very much like Pride with the pomp and circumstance of the 8 guys that they have in this set in this tournament. Just the name recognition value alone is just very strong. It's very exciting. Probably one of the more exciting things Bellator has done in the last several years. you know, it just logistically, I don't know how he pulled it off. I really don't know how you get four light heavyweights to agree to go up to heavyweight and then get guys like Fedor and Mir, you know, and even, you know, an older guy in Chael Sonnen to get all of that coordinated, to get the contracts lined up, to get everything set. It's, you know, it's it was surprising. I knew they were working on the tournament. I didn't know that the field would be this strong.
Yeah, a lot of names. It's telling that, you know, guys like Chuck Congo, for example, guys won like I think 9 out of his 11 Bellator fights, 5 in a row. No involvement in this tournament. And there's a couple other guys, Justin Wren, obviously an interesting story. They are really going for star power, and God bless them. You know, this is a who's who of talent. I was interested in the inclusion of guys like Bader. Really, with Bader, that stood out. Chael's inclusion, that was interesting. And I wonder if this is kind of his last ride towards perhaps the end of his career. But with someone like Bader, a guy just came off a pretty convincing second round TKO win. Still needs a little bit of kind of rub behind him and a little bit of buzz there with some of the hardcores and even the casuals out there. I was interested by his inclusion, and that one definitely stood out to me the most. And also with, you know, guys like Chael and Rampage and things like that, seems to be just strictly a star power play as opposed to a, you know, more competitive play. That's how I took it.
Yeah, and I agree with you there. And I think, you know, it surprised me that Bader was in it, but when I really thought about it, it makes sense. Because if you're going to have one or two of the light heavyweights in that tournament, if you're going to tie them up in this tournament that could go for as long as a year, you might as well incorporate all of them. Because there aren't a ton of top-line light heavyweights in Bellator. They have some pretty good guys at the top there, but, you know, just putting one or two in there may not make much sense if you're going to tie those guys up for a whole year, take them out of the title picture. You might as well put, you know, more guys in there and really incorporate them. You know, Ryan Bader is not a cheap fighter. His contract is going to be on the high side. So you've got big name guys in that tournament that aren't going to be in the mix to fight, you know, Bader outside of the tournament, at least for quite some time. So might as well just put him in there. I was surprised that Congo wasn't in there as well. But anytime you put together a tournament like this, there's going to be logistical issues, contractual issues. So we don't know necessarily what's going on behind the scene. Bobby Lashley is another guy that I thought would be perfect for something like this. But with his commitments to Impact Wrestling or whatever it's called today, you know, it's not necessarily conducive to his schedule. And, you know, putting a guy like that into the tournament, if you tried to crowbar that in there, you could really be hurting yourself because, you know, a guy like that could really, you know, if he advances, could really stretch things out. And as far as guys like Justin Wren, you know, they're going to have to do some alternate fights. You have guys that are competing at 205 going up to heavyweight. And then you have older guys in this tournament. So those are the ingredients for injuries and guys not being able to continue. So, you know, they haven't announced their alternate fights as of yet, but I think we're going to see that those announcements come out sooner rather than later.
So I was trying to kind of look at the, you know, the breakdown of like, you know, what potentially could be these first round matchups, who are they trying to get to in the finals, those type of things. So initially I had put Fedor Chael, Rampage Moe, Bader Nelson, Mitrione Mir. I was just, some of the pat matchups didn't fully make sense, but I was trying to jive them around, figure out, okay, what's going to be the best for, you know, where are they trying to get to, but also kind of like, what is the most interesting fights? And you know, the Chael's been talking about this Fedor fight forever. And to me, like, you know, why risk it? Why not just try to get to it? Rampage Moe, we've seen that a couple times. It was kind of like, maybe that works. Bader Nelson. And with these 205ers, it really kind of throws a monkey wrench into that.
Yeah.
What would you, I mean, kind of looking at these eight guys, how would you match them up in the first round?
Well, I think that it's a ratings play, so you might as well just go for the ratings. I think that Fedor versus Mir, that is a tremendous matchup. You know, there's talk about putting that on the January show, you know, and that looks like, you know, the Rory McDonald fight, you know, putting that on that undercard, that could be a huge, huge fight for them. You know, those are very well-known names. They're obviously far from their prime, but they're two of the more recognizable names in MMA right now. So to have Mir versus Fedor, that has a lot of marquee value. You know, as far as the other matchups, you know, I would like to see them, you know, I would love to see Rampage versus Chael. I know that they're friendly, but they're both professionals on a business level. They like to sell their fights. So I think that even though they get along behind the scenes, I think that, you know, matching them up, I think publicly the two of them would definitely, you know, create a lot of headlines and get Bellator a lot of attention. You know, as far as the other matchups, you know, it's I think a lot of those guys are interchangeable. You know, nothing really stands out too much as far as matchups that I want to see. But anytime you put eight names together like this, you know, it's going to be tough for them to make a bad matchup.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. That's always kind of fun to play around with, and I, you know, expect obviously they'll announce the brackets here before the end of the year. And it's interesting if they do Fedor and Mir on the McDonald's show, but that goes head to head with UFC 220 pay per view coming up in Boston. So the I would say the Monday night wars, but the Saturday night wars are back again. Huh? Should be a lot of fun to kick off the year.
Absolutely.
So we then go to later in the day. So you know, this is the interesting thing with time delay shows and Dublin, Ireland, Bellator putting on an event, not a lot of you know, star power on it, but certainly got a pretty big jump in star power by a certain UFC lightweight champion. He's got to get some news and video from Dublin in the early afternoon that Conor McGregor decided to jump the cage after one of his guys got a big win, decided to shove referee Mark Goddard, who was checking on John Redmond, who was the guy that was dispatched, and McGregor wasn't a licensed cornerman, was kind of just yelling and just being his Conor McGregor self. It was just this surreal thing. I remember getting a note from Dave Meltzer. I hadn't even seen this yet. The afternoon, he's like, yeah, we got to get something up about this Bellator Conor madness. I'm like, what Bellator Conor madness? And looked, I was like, yeah, oh, yeah. I was like, oh, once he said that, I was like, oh my God, what has happened now? And just watching this video. And my first thought after watching this first time through was Bellator and Viacom must just be have the biggest smiles on their face. Drinks are on them Friday night because they had a tape delay show coming up that night that they had at least 5 hours to build interest on social media and all this stuff as far as what happened. I mean, they obviously tagged McGregor on Twitter, all these things. They were in the McGregor business without having him as an actual employee. This was fascinating to see happen, fascinating to watch. We still really kind of don't know what's going to happen out of this. I mean, it sounds like a whole lot of nothing because he wasn't a licensed cornerman. He just was a guy. I can't see UFC suspending him over this. This was absolutely fascinating stuff.
They got a lot of mileage out of that as far as Bellator without spending a single dollar. It's, you couldn't dream something like that up. That's a home run grand slam situation for Bellator. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Josh, when you said it was a tape delay situation. They had all day to promote this. Had this happened live, it obviously would have went viral. Everyone would have talked about it, but it would have been something that I would say SportsCenter and ESPN, those type of shows, would have gotten the biggest bump showing the highlight after the fact. Whereas Bellator had control of this, you know, there was leaked footage out there, but it wasn't, you know, maybe the best camera angle, or it was, you know, grainy, you know, camera phone footage. You knew it was going to happen, but you tuned in to get the full context of it. And Bellator, for about 5 hours there, promoted it as if it was the main event of the show. At least it's on social media, it was promoted that way. I mean, it was promoted as, hey, the big Conor McGregor moment's coming up, tune in. And, you know, he... you know, it's amazing that he would do that. If you're the UFC, you're incredibly upset. You know, and you said it, Josh. They're not going to do anything from a disciplinary standpoint, but behind the scenes, they have to be seething for you know, their top guy, the biggest name in combat sports, a fighter that they have under an exclusive contract to jump the cage and be such a featured so prominently on their competitors' broadcasts, you know, that they're not happy about that. They can't be happy about that. Bellator definitely, you know, we don't know the ratings for sure as this show, you know, is taped, but I got to imagine that they got a pretty nice bump out of that, and they got that bump for free. So, you know, it's just, you know, I just wonder what Conor was thinking. You know, some of his recent actions have been questionable. Look, he's always been wild. He's always been crazy. But I've always felt there's been a method to his madness. But the last two incidents, with the prior incident being, you know, when he was cornering his teammate and, you know, started launching homophobic slurs at Andre Feely, that didn't make too much sense to me. You know, this is a guy now talking about wanting to be a billionaire. Well, that's not good for your brand when you're using hate speech out there. You know, there's, you know, in order to become a billionaire, you need just about everyone to follow you, and hurling, you know, that language out there is not a good look. And then what he did, you know, on Friday night. That's not smart either. You know, pushing a referee, jumping the cage, I don't have that big of an issue. He's Conor McGregor. He's the biggest star in combat sports. Let him jump the cage and do his victory lap. But he took it from that to, you know, pushing a referee, getting physical with a Bellator employee. It defies logic.
Yeah, and it kind of highlights this. You don't see this in other sports that have, or really companies that have I wouldn't say competing interests, but essentially they're competitors in the sense they're in the same business. But, you know, we talked about coming up in January, they're going head to head. But in MMA, you have this situation where guys can work for other companies, but still be part of your TV show in a sense as cornermen. You know, they just kind of are seen in the background. I just think of you know, Benson Henderson went through this whole free agency thing where you have seen Bellator, signs with Bellator. A month or so later, you see him cornering one of his guys at a UFC show. So he's still kind of like top of mind on the big show, but he's not involved or really mentioned by name or so on. Same thing with UFC guys cornering Bellator guys. All this stuff is this weird kind of unwritten rule, or not even a rule, but just this thing that is so unique to MMA, and that you can have guys sign with the organization but still be part of your show, just seen and not heard.
And I can tell you, sorry to cut you off there, but I can tell you this, it's not something, at least when I was the vice president of talent relations for Bellator, it's not something the UFC was very excited about. And, you know, we never heard directly from the UFC about it, but I would talk to managers and I would talk to fighters, and some of them, you know, at least the upper echelon guys, you know, they confessed that they had gotten a phone call or two the week leading up, and, you know, there was pressure at times for them not to corner on our show. And I can tell you several stories where we had got, you know, big name UFC guys backstage, and they had been licensed to corner, and they were there all week with their teammate as a corner man. And then when the show started and the fighter walked out, they were not part of the entourage. They stayed backstage and they watched the monitor. They didn't, for whatever reason, they did not want to come out and be on camera. And, you know, again, it's not something that, it's something that's allowed, but it's not something that the UFC typically is very happy about. And I can't imagine. I would love to be a fly on the wall and hear what the conversation was like within the UFC offices when this McGregor news broke.
Fascinating stuff. Then we get even more fascinating. This is on the same day. So Friday, late in the afternoon or so, we get a report that one of the greatest of all time, Anderson Silva, failing his second USADA test, being flagged. We don't know for what. We don't know and really anything about it. It was an out-of-competition test on October 26th, out-of-competition, like leading up to the fight, not night of, and obviously, or anything like that. But regardless, Anderson Silva is on the shelf. We don't really know a lot of the details at this point. Obviously, people that remember the sex pill stuff from Thailand and all that stuff from last time, but it's hard to, you know, you really don't want to pass judgment until you kind of know what's going on, but you still are like, we see how these things end up and you wonder about, is he going to ever return? We think about legacy, things like that. What did you think that when you first heard this news?
Surprised, but not surprised. You know, I'm a huge Anderson Silva fan, but this really tarnishes his legacy. You know, the sex pill story, you can only really weave a story like that once and get your hardcore fans to buy into that. But when you test positive a second time, you know, that's, you're gonna have a hard time coming up with it with a solid defense. And, you know, he is, you know, unless this has to do with, you know, a tainted supplement, which I'm very skeptical of, unless it's a tainted supplement defense and they can go out and they can test the supplement and provide evidence to, you know, USADA, you know, this could be the end of his career in the UFC. And, you know, unless he wants to wait a year or two and maybe go fight overseas for other promotions, then, you know, this, you know, we may never see Anderson Silva fight in a cage again. You know, it's a sad way potentially for his career to end. He was a guy that, you know, when it came to the greatest, you know, fighter of all time conversation, to me, at least in my personal book, was right up there with Fedor Emelianenko. And, you know, based on Fedor's recent appearances and, you know, the losses that he's taken and his legacy being tarnished, you could make a case that Anderson is number one of all time. But, you know, this really cast a shadow.
Yeah, I wonder, in thinking through this, and some of the other guys have been flagged from USADA and will be flagged and all the things that are to come, I wonder if we'll look back on this era, and I wonder if historians will kind of maybe have difficulties, similar way that baseball historians have difficulties looking through the quote-unquote steroid era. And I don't know if you really kind of class, obviously, this era of MMA or the past as the steroid era, but kind of in like how we look at these guys when it comes to historical framing. You know, do you completely throw out accomplishments based on tests? Do you pick and choose? It's so difficult because we have such an attachment because we've seen them come through, especially in this huge era that we just kind of passed through. And now it's just the game has changed a lot. And do we look at Anderson Silva the same way? Do we completely discount all this stuff? It's something I'm not sure about. Where do you come down on that?
I think some people will look at him the same way, but I think a lot of people won't. You know, you mentioned baseball, and that's a good example. There's people that completely want to disqualify and discount all the accomplishments by the top players of that era. And then there's certain people that kind of just grade that era on a curve with the understanding that that's the way baseball was. That's what the times were during that period of baseball. And, you know, the vast majority of players potentially were all on PEDs. So that kind of, you know, negated everything. And, you know, everyone was on an even plane because just about everyone was cheating. So if you have a very skeptical outlook on, you know, on life and the current era of MMA that we live in, and you believe that not just a few guys and gals are the ones, you know, using PEDs, but that it was widespread and that, you know, the vast majority of competitors out there were on it, then, you know, you see it from the perspective that, hey, yes, everyone was cheating. Yes, there was cheating going on, but everyone was cheating, so it all canceled each other out. So it all comes down to perspective. You know, from my personal perspective, I know a lot of fighters that don't touch that stuff, that didn't use it, that don't use it and will never use it. And I was pretty, you know, cognizant that there was probably a lot of, you know, guys and gals that were using it. You know, I never knew for a fact. I never had that type of contact with fighters where they would confide in me, hey, Sam, you know, that was a great win, but I was on the juice. I never had that level of conversation with a fighter. Yeah. But just being around certain guys and watching all of their performances, and ladies as well, you know, there's certain people, I guess, you know, that Jeff Nowitzki, his term is, they don't pass the eye test. And there are certain fighters that they just didn't pass the eye test. You know, as an athlete, you know, athletes can get faster, they can get bigger. It's almost impossible from my perspective for an athlete to get both bigger and faster at the same time. And, you know, when you see – and there were certain fighters that would come through our cage and you would just see a progression just from – even from 60 to 90 days prior. You know, they'd come into the cage bigger and faster and they'd made weight no problem. And, they were bigger than ever and faster than ever, and just a noticeable change in appearance just from, you know, 90 days prior. And those were the guys that you kind of scratched your head and said, what's going on here?
Yeah. Interesting. Well, certainly won't be the last that we've heard of this or from any other guy. So who knows what's going to come here. But we then go to Saturday, as if Friday wasn't enough. We then go to Saturday. So Saturday starts out. We get an announcement earlier in the day, something I've been kind of talked about a little bit earlier in the week, but it was made official that Max Holloway found a new dance partner for UFC coming up in Detroit, big pay-per-view. He was set to face – oh my God! Why am I blanking? Who is he? Frankie Edgar, of course. Edgar, much anticipated.
Too many injuries, Josh. It's hard to keep track of everything, man.
I know. We could have even gone back further with the whole Dominic Cruz thing, yeah. and the Frankie Edgar injury, obviously. But so we're gonna have Holloway versus Edgar. Really, everyone was looking forward to this fight. Should have been a lot of fun. I think we'll probably get that at some point in the future. Edgar looks to be out maybe about 6 weeks or so, give or take. But we know that goes. And so instead of Ricardo Lamas was being mentioned. There was a couple of lighter weight guys possibly to come up. And, of course, everyone's kind of jockeying for this fight. Michael Johnson even. All these guys, everyone's trying to get in line. But Jose Aldo, the former featherweight champion, he gets his rematch against Max Holloway. That's going to headline the show in Detroit. I think, You know, the last fight, obviously Holloway was pretty dominant in, but I, you know, given all the options available at this stage, I don't mind this rematch. I think it's you know, it's not really a, you know, going to be a huge pay-per-view success or anything like that based on his inclusion, but I think it adds some intrigue. I think there's still a lot of questions about what Aldo has left in the tank at this point. I think with a good accounting of himself, he can kind of get back in good graces. And I mean, I don't want to say he has nothing to lose. Obviously, if he gets starched in 13 seconds like he did against McGregor, I think there's an issue there. But Holloway's at an interesting point in his career, kind of on the ascent and wants to be a bigger deal. And Aldo's kind of trying to figure out where his footing is. So I had no issue with this rematch being made.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of options. Maybe the only other viable option was Cub Swanson. The issue with going in that direction is, from what I understand, you know, based on reports, Cub Swanson only has one fight left on his contract, and that's a big promotional no-no. You'd never put a guy that could go free agent after a potential title win. You don't give him that opportunity. So I don't know where they are with contract negotiations. You know, I don't know if they were even close or if it's even being discussed right now. But without that contract in place, Cub Swanson was never going to be a realistic option unless the UFC was willing to bet, you know, that you know, Holloway was just going to, you know, dominate Swanson, and that there was very little chance that Swanson could get that win and then, you know, become a free agent after that. So, you know, I'm not excited by the Aldo fight, but I don't know if there were really any other viable options.
Yeah, with Swanson too, he's set to main event a show against Brian Ortega in Fresno. So now that adds another wrinkle in it. Now that we kind of know that he's an impending free agent to be, Ortega is a really hot, fast rising prospect at featherweight. So that should be a lot of fun. So yeah, you would have to kind of jumble that around. So in these situations, you know, as you know from being a matchmaker in the past, when people are kind of jockeying for it and couple guys don't get it, then there's always going to be hurt feelings no matter what, but you have to do what's best for the promotion and also what's going to be the best fight to make in general, right?
Right. I mean, there's only one guy that can get that opportunity. So you mentioned, there's a bunch of people that want it, you know, but only one's going to get it. And then you now are in a position where you've got multiple fighters now that have to deal with rejection, and fighters don't necessarily deal with rejection the best.
Then we go to a guy that, speaking of guys that aren't used to rejection, maybe from some certain fan bases, but Michael Bisping.
Yeah.
Speaking of Anderson Silva being,
I don't get this one, Josh. I mean, he was just suspended medically for 30 days by the New York State Athletic Commission. I don't understand this. I mean, I understand it because they're going overseas and it will be a self-regulated show, but the UFC is making a statement by booking this fight saying, you know what, New York State Athletic Commission, we're really the bosses, and, you know, we're not going to respect your suspension. We're not going to honor it, and we know you're not going to do anything, because as soon as we want to come back and bring that tax revenue to you, we know you're not going to do anything punitive against us, so we're just going to go ahead and do this.
Yeah, so Michael Bisping is slotted in to face Kelvin Gastelum about 3 weeks from this obviously a big fight with GSP that we just saw in New York City. This is, what my first thought when I heard this news, one was surprise, but two, I was listening to an old show I did 6 years ago on this radio show I used to do with Marcus Davis. And Marcus was out of the UFC at that point, trying to get back in, finding the regional scene. And he was set to fight twice in 4 months. A couple of regional guys or so on. I remember just being struck by that and be like, wow. And he was, 2 times in 4 months just seems like a lot. There's all these, especially at the local level, there's all these, you hope that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed when it comes to the medicals and things like that, because that just seems to be a lot. Physically, you don't know what happens in the first fight, then the second fight, and so on. But you're right. We had this medical issue with Bisping. It was just, to fight 3 weeks afterwards, it just seems like, it does seem absolutely crazy, but this is the position they put themselves in, where they have to quote unquote save a show. And, you know, Bisping is doing this willingly. I'm sure he's getting a nice payday for it, but this does not seem like the best course of action for a guy kept 3 weeks off a pretty tough fight at a UFC 217. Not at all.
Yeah, and this is not a ticky-tack 30-day medical suspension. I've seen some of those where certain commissions, they just get in the habit, no matter what happens, they don't want a fighter fighting 30 days from their last fight, so they just put on it. 30-day medical suspension, even though the guy or gal is completely healthy and completely fine. But it was a tough fight, like you said. You know, he got dropped. He got, he got submitted. You know, it's just surprising. But the UFC has so much leverage over athletic commissions. Yeah. So by doing this, I'm sure there's a lot of administrators and regulators that are very unhappy about it, but they're all saying this behind closed doors. You're not going to hear a word publicly about it, and you're not going to see anything punitive against the UFC, much like we're not going to see anything punitive against Conor McGregor from Mike Mazzulli. I mean, Mike Mazzulli with the Mohegan Athletic Commission, I know Mike. I worked with him on a lot of different shows. He's a great guy. He's a tremendous regulator, but his hands are tied here. You know, McGregor does not compete at Mohegan. This is not even a Connecticut issue. Mike Mazzulli, his home commission, is Mohegan Sun. You know, that is tribal sovereign land. It's not the state of Connecticut. He, only has jurisdiction over what goes on at that casino. He is the head of the ABC, but the ABC doesn't have unilateral power. They don't have the power to say, I'm going to suspend someone and it's a national suspension. There really is no such thing as a national suspension. What you see when guys get suspended, it's one athletic commission issuing the suspension, and the unwritten rule is, the time-honored tradition is that all the other commissions in the ABC, they honor what the home they honor the suspension that was handed down by the original commission.
Yeah.
So it's a situation where Conor McGregor was not licensed by Mike Mazzulli to corner on that show. He's not going to he's probably never going to be competing at the Mohegan Sun. As the director of the ABC, Mike Mazzulli does not have the power, does not have the mandate to issue a national suspension. So, it makes sense from that regard that, I know he was upset about it, but he just doesn't have the ability to do anything. And even if he did, there's a rogue commission out there now. It's Bernie Profato from Ohio and Tim Lukianoff from Illinois and Missouri, and then some several other states. When Mazzulli was elected the head of the ABC and ended Tim Lukianoff's reign, there was a kind of a split. Several states, they're trying to break off, and they weren't exactly thrilled by, Mike Mazzulli's elevation to that post. Even though he was elected democratically, there were just certain people. They handled the loss of Tim Lukianoff that he was handed in that election. They didn't handle it very well, and they went out and they formed their own commission. So, for Mike, if he comes out too strong here and tries to exceed his mandate, there's going to be a bunch of people that are going to try to take him down, because for whatever reason, they've allowed their egos to get in the way of regulating fights from a fair and realistic perspective. And, Mike Mazzulli, when Bellator goes overseas and they bring in Mike Mazzulli, it's a situation where Bellator is hiring Mike Mazzulli and they're paying him to oversee their event. And let me be clear. I don't have an issue with that. It's really not that much different than what the UFC does when they go overseas. They self-regulate. This is, I think, what Bellator is doing is actually better, as far as fairness and from a regulatory standpoint, because Mazzulli has, he has total say. It's him bringing in his people and him making the decisions over how the commission, that oversees those overseas events runs. Whereas the UFC, it's Mark Ratner that's really running the show. And Mark Ratner is a full-time employee of the UFC. So I don't have an issue with Mike Mazzulli doing that. But, you have people like Tim Lukianoff and Bernie Profato out there. Whereas if Mike was heavy-handed, went out and exceeded his mandate, they're two of the first two guys that could go to the media and start, trying to point fingers at the fact that, Mike, was paid by Bellator to come out and do that show, and Bellator is the biggest competitor of the UFC. So even though I don't have a problem with it, and I don't think anyone should have a problem with it, it would create a potential political issue for Mike, and it wouldn't make sense for Mazzulli to really even cross that plane when he doesn't have the mandate anyway. And again, I can't be clear enough. I don't have an issue with Bellator bringing a guy like Mike Mazzulli in to do that, because when I was at Bellator, we brought Mike in to regulate our shows because he's such a good regulator and has such a good reputation. But, it's, again, you look at it from afar when you have critics out there. You've got, a guy who is the head of the ABC who is, being paid to go overseas and regulate a Bellator show, put in a position where he's got to make a ruling on the biggest star in all of combat sports, who happens to be under contract to the chief rival of Bellator.
Hmm. So do you foresee a situation in the year ahead that there's essentially two, I'll say, rival groups that are regulating and now
no.
You don't? Okay.
I'm sorry to cut you off there, but this other commission, you know, and I've worked with Tim. I've worked with Bernie. They were nothing but professional with me when we did shows in their respective states. But, you know, this idea that they're going to start a secondary commission that's going to rival the ABC, it's just nonsense. Because the ABC, a lot of people question how much authority the ABC really has from a national perspective. It's just a bunch of, you know, individual commissions getting together and trying to work in unison. But at the end of the day, each home commission makes their own decision. And, you know, the ABC itself, which has been around for years, has limited authority from a national perspective. So what is this, you know, rogue commission, this rogue athletic association, what power are they really going to have outside of their own home jurisdictions? I know they get together, they meet, and they have, you know, opinions and positions on the way things should be done in MMA from a national perspective, but they just don't have the juice to really implement a lot of these positions. And, you know, I just don't see it really going anywhere. I never understood why it was an issue to begin with. If they have an issue with Mike Mazzulli, if they have an issue with his ascent to, you know, head of the ABC, then just wait until the next election and run against them.
Interesting stuff. So we then go to actually the in-cage stuff, which kind of completes our journey. Fun show in UFC Norfolk on Saturday night. We had an excellent main event. We had notable finishes. We had really everything in between. This was a really fun show. A lot of veterans making their case for big fights in the year ahead. We had call-outs, all kinds of fun stuff. Other than the main event, because we'll get to that in a second, what stood out to you the most about Saturday night?
To be honest, I didn't really watch too much of it.
Okay.
You know, so I'd have to be honest with you, Jason. I don't have a good answer to that question.
No problem. I will. I'll tell you what. I'll guide you through some stuff. So we had an excellent main event with Anthony Pettis and Dustin Poirier. It was everything that the casual would like, the hardcore would like. It was full of it was back and forth, lots of blood. There was a doctor stoppage, but a doctor came in the cage checking Anthony Pettis for a deep cut, let him fight anyway. That gets a nice crowd pop. And then Dustin Poirier was on top of Pettis, and then it looked like Pettis may have broken a rib, some sort of issue when he was on bottom, kind of one of those freak injuries. And then the fight ended, Poirier calling out the winner of Eddie Alvarez and Justin Gaethje and really kind of making a case for himself as a top lightweight. He had a great promo afterwards and interesting guy at 155. This was a classic, perfect TV main event and everything you could have asked for and more. We had Matt Brown in possibly what could be his retirement fight, knocking out Diego Sanchez, the old guard, still hanging on after tough one, but a very brutal finish by elbow. Just a perfectly timed elbow from Matt Brown, just completely crumpled Diego Sanchez. Clay Guida ran through Joe Lozon first round, and then it was an interesting thing. And if you get to see the video, this would be interesting your take on this. But we found out it was Clay Guida's last fight on his contract, and he made it very clear to the fans that he wants to keep fighting in the UFC, so he led the crowd in cheers of Guida, and he tried to get him to say UFC, and they kind of just kept chanting Guida. But really appealing to the public and the fans to let Dana White and crew know that if they want him to keep fighting in the UFC, they have to let them know. So very interesting philosophy there.
Yeah, and it's interesting because typically the UFC doesn't allow you – if they want you back and you're – salary expectations are reasonable. Typically, it doesn't get to the point where you go into a fight with the last one on your deal. You know, typically they want to get that extension done before that fight elapses and your contract goes to free agent. So the fact that they haven't extended him a deal and they haven't made that deal happen says to me that they may not necessarily want him back, or if they do, maybe not at the pay rate that he's at, because he's been in the UFC for a very long time. So he's making a lot of money and he's not a title contender. He's basically just an established veteran that has some popularity, who's been there for years and may not necessarily the ROI on him may not necessarily be that strong in comparison to his current price point. So, you know, that says to me that, you know, that's a guy that Bellator probably would love to have in their organization. You know, that he's a guy that, you know, hasn't always had the most exciting fights, but is capable of having exciting fights when he lets it go. And he's a solid name. You know, he's a guy that's been around, been in some big fights. So you look at some of the guys that, you know, that Bellator's tried to bring over. Yeah, they brought in top rated guys like Ben Henderson and Rory McDonald, but they also brought in guys that like Josh Koscheck and Chris Lieben and Stefan Bonner, just based on name recognition alone. You know, they were guys that weren't going to compete for a title in their organization and were well past their prime, but they wanted the name recognition value. So being able to have a guy like Clay Guida go on the open market, you know, it's interesting that he was not retained before that point. And says to me that the UFC could be ready to let him go. And it's good that Bellator has gone out and increased the profile of level of free agents that they've been bringing into the organization, because now there's a potential second home for a guy like Clay Guida. You know, maybe 5 years ago, if Clay Guida was in this situation, he'd have to consider retirement. Now there's another place where he can go and possibly get paid a lot of money to fight.
Mm. Yeah, you have a guy in Diego Sanchez that near the end of his career – you know, someone that's been knocked out viciously, has not looked good. You know, I think he's, you know, obviously almost 40 years old. Kind of like, as a promoter, obviously, I'm sure you've had plenty of in a matchmaker. You've seen plenty of guys where you're like, I don't, you know, you have that feeling that maybe it's time to hang them up. How tough is that conversation? And then how do you go into that conversation? How do you approach them?
It's, you know, a tough conversation to have, and I've never outright told a fighter to retire. I've told fighters that, you know, there's medical issues that they've got to get addressed, and, you know, maybe they could benefit from some time off. But, you know, it's not an easy conversation to have, because at the same time, while I could tell a fighter to retire, you know, I'm not in a position to pay their bills once they leave. So I don't know their financial situations. I don't know their obligations. And for certain guys, even guys that are college educated, you know, if, you know, just because they have a college degree, if they've been fighting for 10 or 15 years, they've been out of the workforce for so long, they may not have the related experience needed to get a well-paying job. And it's tough to expect a guy in his late 30s or early 40s to go out and get an entry-level job for very little money and try to, you know, sustain their family and work their way up the corporate ladder. So for a lot of guys, it's tough. You know, there were certain guys, you know, Eric Prindle was a guy and Travis View. There were two guys that, you know, we spoke with and, you know, they had both expressed a desire to continue. So we just had to make a decision to let them both go. But it's never an easy conversation to have. And, you know, for certain guys, again, it goes back to even if they're college educated, even if they have that college degree, once you do something for so long, it's not necessarily an easy transition to go out and do something else.
Yeah, and I suspect those. Well, additionally, it would a bigger corporate entity like UFC or you know, or WME, IMG, Viacom, all this, there always has to be in the back of their mind some sort of you know, potential lawsuit down the road. We've seen this happen with obviously the concussion stuff and everything, that really they have to be able to cover themselves. And even though it is the fight business, that there is that possibility where if they let a guy go too long and it's on their watch, they can always look back and say, hey, I didn't really, you know, I didn't really understand what I was doing. You kind of let me do this. You know, we kind of all know how that plays out. So I'm sure there's some sort of culpability there they have to be concerned about with some of these guys as they reach the end of their careers.
And that's the real shame of this, is that there aren't enough opportunities within fighting outside of the cage. You know, the UFC, they have a lot of commentators right now, but they're typically guys that are active fighters. And for a lot of retired guys, there just really aren't those opportunities. You look at baseball and football, you know, somebody retires from baseball or football, they can become an intern with, you know, do some coaching interns and then eventually get a paid position coaching either at the college level or the NFL level, or even a head, you know, head position as a high school coach, which, you know, may not be the best pay in the world, but it's a living, you know, and they're still in the sport that they grew up playing. You look at the networks, there's, you know, so many networks that cover baseball, that cover football. There's plenty of broadcast opportunities. The opportunities outside the cage in MMA right now are just so limited, and you're going to find a lot of guys that have not saved and planned properly that are, you know, already having financial issues, and we're going to see more guys have those issues.
Absolutely. You're right. Yeah. It seems like there's more active talent that are afforded those opportunities as opposed to retired talent, which is.
Yeah. And the guys that you know, the active talent, they don't need that income. I'm sure they want it and they like having it, but the guys that really need it are the retired fighters.
Right. No, I would agree. I would agree. Well, you've been very generous with your time, Sam. We did a wild spin through a wild 36 hours. And before I let you go, I know you've kind of been away from the spotlight a little bit, but give you a chance to plug where people can interact with you and any other stuff you're working on, and the floor is yours.
Not much to plug. Just check me out on Twitter at Sam Kaplan MMA. That's Kaplan with a C.
There you go. You follow him on Twitter, and yeah, hopefully you talk again. We'll chat again with about another wild stretch in MMA. But yeah, it's been an interesting year, and I think we're gonna have quite a run towards the stretch. No doubt about it. Plenty of big news to come. Sam Kaplan, thanks so much for returning to Josh Nason's Punch Out.
Thank you, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Big thanks to Sam Kaplan for dropping by. Follow him on Twitter. Let him know you heard him on the show and all that good stuff. Wild, crazy night on wild. You keep saying wild and crazy. It's really the only way to describe it, all the stuff that happened. The UFC Norfolk, that was a lot of fun. We really didn't get into it on the show, but from top to bottom, intrigue, interesting to kind of see where people are at in their careers. Rafael Sunsau making a bid for a shot against TJ Dillashaw. We'll have to see if that happens. I think he's probably looking for bigger names, but it's hard to deny a Sunsau has earned a bantamweight title shot at this point. And speaking of bantamweights, we had Marlon Moraes, big victory, decides to call out Jimmy Rivera for that fight in December. That's obviously going to be pretty big if that happens. Interesting stuff. And you wonder if maybe a Sunsau should have gone that direction, and maybe Moraes jumped the line a bit. But hey, that's what you got to do these days. And we'll see if that happens as well. Let's see, Bellator. I actually still have not seen the actual full Bellator show, just kind of the Conor stuff. So I'll be looking to check that out. And again, that was the biggest news of the show, was that Conor McGregor running. Unbelievable. Just like something out of, the Monday Night Wars. You know, guys crossing over and all that good stuff. And again, you the things that went through my mind when Dave sent me that email, because again, I hadn't seen anything yet, that we got to get something up about the Bellator McGregor craziness. I'm like, oh my God, what happened? Oh, it's just, I just didn't know. Did he sign? Did he say he was going to sign with Bellator, headline a pay-per-view, do something crazy? Like, again, crazy. Something insane like that? Like, what happened? So, running in the cage, shoving, nothing's going to happen to the guy, but, he's never out too far away from the spotlight or the headlines, and we'll have to see if we actually get him inside a UFC cage before the end of the year. Seems unlikely, but, you never know in this game. And coming up this weekend, I would say a rather nothing show, looking at the card. Fabricio Werdum taking on Marcin Tybura where is this show? Is it Poland or something like that? Let me actually look this up while I have you guys with me for another minute or so. All right, we'll go here. It is in, Sydney, Australia. That's right. This was the Mark Hunt fight that got put away when Hunt got let go, but removed from the card. So yeah, Fabricio Werdum, Marcin Tybura, Beck Rawlings and Jesse Rose Clark, Tim Means versus Bilal Muhammad. That should be fun. Jake Matthews, kind of interesting to see where he's still at in his young career. Elias Teodoro, the Spartan against Dan Kelly, a veterans fight. And there is Will Brooks versus Nick Lentz is on the prelim. So that was a fight that was moved from earlier this year. Yeah, there's not a lot on here. So hopefully there will be a lot of finishes to at least make it a little bit newsworthy. But that's happening on FS1 coming up this Saturday, 10 o'clock. Yeah, nothing to really, change your plans for to catch this show. But again, it's show every single week, and there's bound to be a couple dogs. And this one, as far as star power, appears to be that way. But hey, you never know. We'll see what happens. And again, on Thanksgiving week, and we have Michael Bisping versus Kelvin Gastelum headlining that show from Shanghai, China. What else is on that show? Not a lot. Wow, that is Chase Sherman's on that show. Alex Caceres, Legion Lang, yeah, Zach Otto. Eesh, boy, that is a fight pass show if I have ever seen one. Wow, that is a very boring card. So that next couple weeks, There's not a lot happening. So it looks like we're looking forward to the first week in December with the tough finale, and then Holloway Aldo 2 the next night, and then, on to some big fights in December. So with all that said, we're going to let you go. Big thanks again to Sam Kaplan. Thanks to all you. Again, you have a lot of choices in your podcasting and content day. So the fact you spend almost an hour with me almost every single week is greatly appreciated. So on behalf of everyone, thanks again. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out episode. What episode is this? It's 83. This is 83. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.